Good afternoon. Thank you for that introduction, and thank you for welcoming us, the Nutrition Security Program, here to the meeting. You challenged me. I don't know if I'm going to answer all those questions that you raised, but I will describe and talk about a program in Haiti, which I'm quite excited about. The title of my presentation is on building social capital. I want to say that I have no disclosures to, no relationships to disclose, but I do want to acknowledge my colleagues, my co-authors who are not on the written here, but one of them, Dr. Jutia Wasso, is here. She's a senior technical advisor on the program based in Haiti. And then Andy Thomas, who is our program backstop in Washington at Partners of America. Social capital. Social capital has been defined as the relationships, the networks, the trust, and the reciprocity that exists within social networks. So they could be very close networks of family, as you can see on the upper right, of family networks, of neighbors, of really close friends that have a very strong bonding kind of relationship where they share a similar background, whether it's ethnic, age, or family ties. They also share norms and cultural beliefs and ways of doing things. Then you also have a bridging social capital is defined as bridging, where you bring together a slightly weak tie. So that may be an acquaintance or a friend or someone who's not right in that immediate close bond, who can bring in new information, new ways of doing things, can challenge some of those norms if the ties to them are a little bit open. And then we have our linking social capital, which is that relationship that links the individual or the community to networks that are more powerful or have more resources, such as your health workers or your political leaders or other community leaders, that would give them access to more resources than they would normally have within their small, very close-knit bonds. Also, you find that within social capital, researchers are beginning to see how, researchers and program managers in particular, how we can utilize those bonds, particularly in low-resource areas, to strengthen those bonds, increase them, bring in more linkages, to mediate the impact of poverty on nutrition and health. So I'd like to describe a program, the Nutrition Security Program, which is being implemented in Haiti. It is funded by USAID, and we are operating in four departments of Haiti, the North, the Northeast, the West, and Artibonite. Now Haiti shares the island of Hispaniola with the Dominican Republic. For those of you who may not be familiar, Haiti is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. The income level of about over 78% of the population of Haiti is living on about $2 a day. So we have high levels of poverty there. Although Haiti's major sector economically is agriculture, it still does not produce enough to feed its population, and 60% of its food is being imported. However, Haiti is a beautiful country. We have beautiful beaches and mountains, but we also have high rates of crowding. I think it's the second most crowded country in the Western Hemisphere. We also have we have very poor sanitation. There is no centralized water and sanitation system in Haiti. We have very poor housing, and we have lots of flooding that happens during the rainy season, and so that you find we have seasonal rivers that exist. And this is a picture of a river that used to be a road, that now in order to cross over to the other side, you have to take a small boat. We also find in Haiti that we have low levels of education. 33% of the population have a primary education, and 27% of the population has no education at all. 80% of the population that we surveyed in our beginning of our program, we found had no connection to a, or did not belong to any formal community organization or group. Nutritional status in Haiti is very low. In the four areas that I told you where we're operating, in the four departments, we find that malnutrition is higher than the national average, which you see is the darker of the blue lines on the right. Wasting is, underweight is almost 15%, over 10% in most of the areas. Severe acute malnutrition is over 3%, approaching 5%. Maternal low BMI is over 10%, up to as high as 15% in three of our departments. And in addition, you find the very high rates on the right of maternal overweight. And you often find this in very poor conditions where the same dietary practices that cause underweight in children cause overweight in adults. Our program objective, we are working along very closely with the Ministry of Health and Population to reduce the prevalence of underweight among children under 5 years of age by 5% over 3 years. Our program started in 2013, in May of 2013, and will be ending in May of 2016. It's a very short, brief, 3 year program, and so we are doing all we can to really hit hard at the malnutrition, to prevent malnutrition. We're promoting optimal infant feeding practices, trying to address the 1,000 days. We're also dealing with maternal nutrition in pregnancy and during lactation, and trying to reach, improve complementary feeding of children under 2 years of age. We're promoting exclusive breastfeeding, trying to improve dietary diversity, trying to increase meal frequency and the diets of pregnant women, and also trying to increase the utilization of maternal health services. In Haiti, between 40 and 60%, depending on the area, of women actually deliver in a health facility. However, there are a lot of traditional beliefs and practices that impact the nutrition in Haiti of during that 1,000 days. We have a practice called LOC, which is a prelactal feed that is given to the child soon after birth, which is usually made up of all the dirtiest possible things, thinking it would inoculate the child against these dirty things, which leads to diarrhea. And then also in Haiti, practice with diarrhea is to purge the child if they have diarrhea. So you can see the kinds of problems that would cause. We also have low rates of exclusive breastfeeding. The diet, as was shown in Ethiopia, I think, as well, is high in cereals and carbohydrates and low in fruits and vegetables and animal source proteins. And we also have, as I mentioned earlier, low rates of utilization of maternity services. The Nutrition Security Program takes the care group approach. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but I'll run through it really briefly. But we do it from a family-centered perspective. On the left, we have supervisors, staff, who train promoters, and those promoters then have care groups of 10 to 12, as we call them, mother leaders, who then visit 10 to 12 families, neighbor women with children under 5, that they educate. So it's a cascade approach of promoting optimal infant feeding and maternal nutrition practices. Each promoter, to start the program, we went into communities and asked the communities to identify women that they thought would be best to be trained, who had children under 5, to educate their neighbors about this. And then the promoters gathered them into these groups. In addition, we have grandmother groups because we're using a family-centered approach, and I think someone else mentioned about the influence of other family members on behavior. So we have groups of grandmothers, we have groups of youth who are the next generation and also are the main caregivers, supporters of young children in the household, as well as groups of fathers that we educate. In total, we are reaching, with our care group approach, almost 21,000 households in Haiti in our four departments. Now, looking at building social capital, as I described to you, the bonding effect, we have the 188 care groups, which are reaching 2,000 mother leaders. And within that group, we are strengthening the bonds within for those women within their families in terms of the information that they have available to them. As I mentioned, we have high rates of low education, so in order for people with low education to get more information, this is an approach to strengthen that bond. And then we have 71 fathers groups. We are reaching about 1,400 men. And the fathers groups, we do not treat men like male women. We have a curriculum that we go over with men, talking about male roles within the family, male roles in terms of nutrition, supporting their wives or mothers of their children, supporting their family relationships, communications within the family. We also address intimate partner violence within our discussions with men. And what we found has been successful, that we have been successful with the men, is that now the men want to do more. Our point of training the men was to be able to open that door within families, to have a support for the mother leaders, that when mother leaders go and visit neighbor women, if there is some resistance in the household, they can call upon a man in the community. This man could speak up. He could speak up in other community gatherings. He would be able to open up some of the barriers, possibly. But now the men want to be father leaders. So they now get T-shirts, and they want to talk to other men, and they really want to promote the message amongst other men in the community. And we're really proud of that. They took that on themselves. With our adolescent groups, we have 83 adolescent health groups that consist of about 654 boys and about 1,058 girls. Haiti has a 37% of the population is between the ages of 10 and 19 years of age. So this is a powerful group to reach with information, education, and knowledge about nutrition, particularly also the young girls. You know that nutrition starts from their age, that they're the future mothers, and if they are healthy going into marriage and pregnancy, the possibility that they will have a healthy child is increased. Some of the things we cover with the youth, again, we know that they are not mothers, so we cover things that are relevant to youth. In addition to nutrition, we talk about life skills and values, about civic engagement and leadership, and the importance in their decision making. Now, for bonding and bridging, we have the grandmother groups. We have 85 grandmother groups that are reaching about 1,300 elder women, who are also gatekeepers of knowledge. They're the ones who practice the lock and pass on that knowledge. So with them on our side and supporting the other mothers and the neighbor women and the mother leaders, we know that we'll be able to better address this normative behavior. They also are called upon to speak in their churches and their communities because they're respected elder women. And so we want to make sure that everybody's on message and supportive of exclusive breastfeeding, dietary diversity, et cetera, et cetera. And then once in each of the communities in which we work, we have what we call a plenary session where we bring together the men's groups, the women's groups, the mother leader groups, the youth groups, and the grandmother groups all together in like a big community meeting. And at that time, as you see, we demonstrate all of the diet diversity, the types of foods that are locally available, highly nutritious foods that are available. And we have competitions where the mother leaders get to answer questions around the and their neighbor mothers, neighbor women, answer questions that around the topics that they've been covering over the past few weeks. And then those who have answered them correctly win a prize of some of this food of their choice. And what it does is it builds the self-esteem of the mother leader, because her neighbor mothers get to see that she's part of a whole movement of women, that she's connected to this organization, that it's not just her nagging them by knocking on the door with one more lesson about how to take care of your baby. And it also shows the community that we are a large group of supporting people in nutrition and are promoting optimal feeding, and you find kids are peeping through the fence, they want to come in. Mother leaders and the neighbor mothers do come with their children. We have senior people in the community who come and address these groups. So it builds the self-esteem and it empowers the mother leaders, that people know that they are women of knowledge. Then with our, on the bridging social capital side, we bridge the community with health services. And on the one side, we, as Gretchen mentioned, about with the malnourished, the severely malnourished child who's been admitted to the hospital. Once they are released, you find that they often come back. So in order to prevent that recidivism, we are working with some of our senior mother leaders who have been trained for a full year, who are doing very well, very knowledgeable, that they are supporting a group of severely malnourished children who've been released. So they're released to the into our hands in the community, and we have meetings with them. Instead of just making sure that they get their plumpy nut and they go back for their appointment at the health facility to pick up the plumpy nut or the plumpy stuff, that we also do an education, that this is a time they can learn about how to feed, how to care for the baby, how to use clean water, and how to change the diaper, wash your hands, etc. All of those things, those nutrition-specific behaviors that can impact this child, as well as do some cooking demonstrations, and we provide them with a package that they take home of the foods that we are teaching them how to cook in the cooking demonstration. So they get their first installment when they go home and make sure that in addition to the plumpy stuff, they have food to feed the child. As well as we encourage the people, say, you have the food, this is the food, but we can't afford to buy it. You can grow some things, particularly those dark green leafies that we want them to eat. The moringa plant is a magical tree that you can eat just about every part of it. It grows fast. You can even burn it to cook your food. And we also supply them with moringa trees and training on how to take care of the seedlings that we give them. Often when you give folks the seedlings, they take it home, they stick it in the ground, and then it doesn't grow, and that's the end of it. But they will receive a training. And we've had good participation of these mothers, where many other T-Foyer approaches, the PV Hearth type approaches, have had trouble in Haiti because these groups are stigmatized. You bring together women who have children who are malnourished, so you're saying something about their ability to be a good mother. However, because of our, we're well established in the community and we're having these community groups and activities, people know us, so when they see this group of women, it's just another group. You know, oh, that's those people are doing that women's thing, and so they don't feel stigmatized and they've stayed with us. Also with our bridging social capital, our mother leaders have decided, we've tried, as I mentioned before, about now you want to diversify the diets, you want to provide them with some seedlings so people can grow, have a little kitchen garden and grow the vegetables and things. We've tried some things, and I was pleased that other people at the podium talked about some of the failures or the things that you were surprised to see. We tried a community nursery, and we had these beautiful nurseries put up in the community that people would share, but nobody took responsibility for them because it's community. That's your nursery. You came and built it. And so the mother leader stepped up and said that, okay, we can have a little garden that of our own, and we can share that with our neighbor mothers. So they get the seedlings, and they are training their neighbor mothers in how to care for it. And that also is a small little income generation for them. And so we could see our gardens look good now. Also within linking social capital, that you find that your community and religious leaders, community and religious leaders are trained. We have 216 of them that we've trained. We've trained 475 traditional birth attendants, 70 auxiliary nurses, and 144 community health workers. All of these people are working within the same communities that we are. We want to make sure that we all understand what we're doing and that we're all on message and promoting and supporting the optimal behaviors. We also demonstrate, we model behaviors on how to train, to talk to mothers about infant feeding. And so on the right is one of our promoters talking with a group of mothers, and on the left is an auxiliary nurse that we've trained and supplied and provided her with a chart book so that she can talk to mothers, engage them in a conversation, as opposed to, as you know, they usually preach at mothers, shouting, do this, do that. So what are the results of all of that? Preliminary results we have here on exclusive breastfeeding. On the left was our initial baseline that we did, programmatic baseline, and we had exclusive breastfeeding in our communities at about a rate of 46%. And on the right is a small survey, a special study we did amongst the neighbor women that we are serving in the four departments. And we found that 85% of them report that they exclusively breastfeed, those with children under 6 months of age. In terms of dietary diversity, these are the seven food groups that we collected information on. To the left, the green ones are cereals, which we found in the early survey there was a high rate of consumption of cereals. If you see the orange one, that those are eggs. There is traditionally a taboo against women eating eggs during pregnancy and lactation. And then, as you can see on the right, the survey we did in the same time of year in July, that the eggs, I'm really excited, is 84% are actually eating eggs. We really broke through that barrier. As well as the foods have increased in the types of food groups that people are reporting that they are eating. And we also found that maternity services, utilization of maternity services has increased, that in our communities before, we had about 53% of women reported that the last child was delivered in a health facility or with a trained health professional, either auxiliary nurse, a nurse midwife, or in a health facility. Whereas our study, special study we did, we found that 88% of our neighbor mothers in our communities did. So our program has only been running for 1 year, and we're about to actually, implementation has been running for 1 year, and we hope that these behaviors will be able to be sustained now that we have a cadre of women who are knowledgeable, who are sharing and training their neighbor women. Merci en peu. Thank you very much.
I hope all of you noticed in the picture of the children in the tea foyer or in the child feeding program where the mothers are preparing the food, how many of those children who are being treated for malnutrition had red hair. Did you all notice that? No black shiny hair among those children. That's an early sign of malnutrition, and we see that a lot in Haiti. So this is very heartening. The tea foyer approach, part of the idea of that is that the foyer is the kitchen, the outdoor kitchen in Haiti. And the idea is that mothers cook in their kitchen with the mothers of malnourished children every day those foods that will help the child recover. And we continue that for 2 weeks because we look for that smile on the 11th day. And just demonstrating the food is interesting, but if you demonstrate a change in the child, that's impressive. And you really have to have the kids have extra calories and protein for about 2 weeks to include that 11th day when we finally see the smile. So it's very, very important. And as she said, Haiti is the most malnourished country in the Western Hemisphere, but how interesting that we have obesity in the mothers and severe malnutrition in the children. So education should make a lot of difference. I want to thank this panel. I think they were wonderful, and open this to questions. Yes.
How did you address that in the book?
come to, maybe you'd like to come to the microphone. Thank you.
Thank you for that question. That's why we did the family-centered approach, because the mother leaders would go into the household and talk to the family, and you could find those barriers. But as we developed groups of fathers that we talked to who can now talk to other fathers, and groups of grandmothers, so you get them together so that they can talk about separately what the issues are, the concerns, the constraints, their experiences, whereas when you mix them together, like at the household, she may not be able to, the grandmother or the man might not be able to speak up their displeasure or some beliefs they may have, but if they have their own group, they can work through that with a facilitator, one of the promoters with them, so that we can improve their knowledge and awareness. The other thing is that grandmothers are not always old women, that oftentimes the generations, as you see in Haiti, have such a large youthful generation, we have high adolescent pregnancy rates, the generations are short. And so you find that a grandmother may be a mother of a young child as well, or recently. So she's heard some of these messages in the health center, but by being in this grandmother group and by our approach being a full family-centered approach, it can be reinforced and she can be helped to pass that on to the next generation.
Very good question. Are there other questions? I just want to reinforce the idea a little bit that we're talking about, people talk about food demonstrations and they often think we are demonstrating that food. This wasn't the case. These foods are, what was demonstrated was the change in the child. And that's very important. So the foods are important, but if you're refeeding a child, and Dr. Jelliff at the University of California used to always say, this isn't feeding children, this is refeeding a child. These children recovering from malnutrition do not need just the minimum daily food requirement, calorie requirement, protein requirement. These children have to be refed, and so you're rehabilitating a child. You need calorie-dense foods and protein, and you need to be able to do it sustainably for long enough with that child to see a change in the child. And if the mother is just in the hospital, and the hospital's treating this kid for pneumonia and everything else, the mothers, when they leave the hospital, will attribute the change in the child to the medicine. And so getting it outside the hospital, as they have done, and into the community, now there's a change in the child. Nobody was giving those children penicillin shots. Nobody was giving those children antidiarrheals. There's a change in the child, and it's attributable mainly to the nutrition. And so, you know, teaching mothers in the hospital, and as she mentioned, preaching at them, doesn't do much good, because that injection that the child gets every day is what the mother sees, and that's what she will attribute the child's recovery to. But out in the community, you can take a different approach. The change in the child is due to nutrition, and it makes a big difference to the mothers in what they're seeing and what they understand. Any other questions? Yes. I welcome anybody to the panel.
The analysis that we conducted was part of a broader set of research that we want to do that's tied directly to our programming. So we're an implementing organization, and we have the luxury of having funds set aside to do research. And so one of the next steps that we, from looking at this and other similar analyses where there were some interesting findings related to the same topic, we actually went ahead and started to gather instruments and measures around different aspects of relationships and relationship quality. And we tested a scale that we've come up with based on other scales in the literature in Malawi. And we have this, what we're calling the couples functionality assessment tool to start to be able to measure some of our work in this and how different aspects of the relationship quality may or may not be related to different behaviors that we're seeing. So we've started to apply this already, and in our ongoing programming, we continue to try to innovate and to inform it with research.
The question was on the next steps. You have to talk in the microphone. The question, we want to make sure this gets in the tape. The question was on the next steps and how do you reinforce that and move it on to the next group or whoever's going to take on. What the next steps would be and how do you ensure that the information gets on to the next group that would take over. So I'm going to let Dr. Wasso talk about that in Haiti.
Thank you. The next step is now we are picking the most leader in the group that we have, the mothers, the fathers, the grandmothers, and the youth, and we are trying to build a kind of special capacity in them, like they can act at the same thing that the promoters are doing. So by January, we plan to train them with a new material to continue the nutrition aspect and to introduce the hygiene and other behavior change in the community. So now those mothers will be working for 3 months before the end of the project to lead those groups without our support. With and without our support, we will have the promoters back and forth supporting those mothers, and they will take the lead. We also include the saving groups inside of those groups, so those mothers are putting money together, so they will keep connecting, and we connect them with the community health center in the community. So they are very in deep link with the community leaders, the community health worker, the auxiliary nurses, and the leadership inside of the group would build it. Yes, exactly.
For us, the Nutrition Improvement Program actually started out of an AIDS care and treatment program. And they've now seen that having these nutrition counselors are actually useful for providing services outside of AIDS care and treatment. And this opportunity that we had to evaluate our program allowed us to also look more extensively at our monitoring and evaluation system. And I think it was a good opportunity for Cameroon Baptist Convention to continue to collect ongoing data on their nutrition counselors. It's a bit of a new approach for them. It's something we're very used to in the United States of collecting data, but getting them to do that is a new step. And going through this process is very useful for them to see how important it is to look at what is that end user approach, which in this case is the caregiver. And so being able now to have our monitoring evaluation system in place to look at how the nutrition counselors are doing within themselves and their improved knowledge, but then also what is the improvement that we see within our caregivers and the children that continue to come back for services.
Yeah, and in our situation, it can be difficult because for the most part, we have students returning to the community and students turn over. But all of us have made a commitment to the site. We're going back in a few months to kind of continue where we left off in helping develop these community-based programs or family-based programs. And the most helpful way that we feel we can continue this endeavor is to supply all that information to the local providers, because they're the ones who are going to be utilizing these types of systems. So we're hoping that through continuously being able to go back for the next foreseeable future, we'll be able to kind of monitor ourselves, but also put a large burden of that responsibility onto the local providers, because that's the main way that we feel we can, that sustainability can be achieved.
Thank you.
I have to ask somebody who's got their book in front of them, what time is our session supposed to end?
4 o'clock.
So we still have, we don't have any more time. So, but I would invite any of you who still have questions to please come up to the front and talk to these wonderful speakers who have really taught us a lot today about how to combat malnutrition.